We're going to open the House Interim Committee on Human Services and Housing on Thursday, May 29th, 2014. And we are going to have the update on the federal investigation of Oregon's mental health system. And we have Pam coming, Pam, Juliet, Tim Mahoney, and Kevin McChesney. Maybe.
Mr. Mahoney.
Thank you. Were you? I didn't see you. Thank you for coming today on an early Thursday morning.
Thank you for having us. Good morning, and for the record, my name is Pam Martin, and I'm the Director of the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to provide an overview and update on the Olmstead decision work that we're doing with the United States Department of Justice. May I have that PowerPoint up? I thought I would run through this very, very quickly because I know there are other people who you want to talk to. Just as a reminder, in 1999, the Supreme Court case affirmed that mental illness is a form of disability and therefore covered by the Americans with Disability Act. And in interpreting the Americans with Disability Act, the court relied on the integration mandate, a regulation issued by the U.S. Department of Justice, which requires public entities to, and I quote, administer services, programs, and activities in the most integrated settings appropriate to the needs of qualified individuals with disabilities. And the impact of this on states is that almost every state has an Olmstead plan, and we certainly do in Oregon. Our plan was developed in 2011 as a two-year plan. Some of the main goals were to reduce the lengths of hospitalization for Oregon State Hospital patients, to develop more independent living environments, prevent hospitalization to begin with, and to increase consumer participation. And we had a number of initiatives that I think this committee is familiar with, such as the Early Assessment and Support Alliance and the Adult Mental Health Initiative, that have been working to achieve and meet some of these goals. For example, with the Aim High Adult Mental Health Initiative, funding is provided that is non-Medicaid funding to help people get established in the community, such as repairs, first and last month's rent, utilities, some of those things that get people back into their community living. So USDOJ does investigations about possible violations of the integration mandate. They normally do an investigation, there are findings, and there's a settlement. And then there are typically mandated services. There are settlement agreements in Georgia, Delaware, North Carolina, Mississippi, and a number of other states that we haven't talked about where the investigations involve primarily people with intellectual or developmental disabilities. So the USDOJ in Oregon, I think as you know, began investigations around the state hospital in 2006. After a significant investment, a new facility was built in Salem and began operations in 2010, and the investigation turned to community. In 2012, there was a letter of agreement with USDOJ, and their investigation was put on hold. Our letter from them is a four-year agreement. The first year was to collect data systems. Second was to identify gaps. The third year, which is the year we're going into, is to identify outcome measures. And year four is to determine progress and make adjustments. So in the first... Oops, sorry.
Pam, why don't you skip, because we've heard a lot about the data collection and
okay.
the gaps. So what the gaps are and how we've been moving. I mean, you stated that one of the things is to keep people out of the hospital, and if they're in the hospital, to be able to get them out quickly. So tell us how that is going.
Thank you, Senator Representative Tomei, for moving us forward, because That is going, I think, well. We met with USDOJ in January, and in their letter, which I can make available to the committee if you would like, they felt encouraged by the commitments that we had made, and they were especially happy about the recent funding, the legislative funding into community-based services, and we are having quarterly conversations. So the gaps in the community services were in crisis services, in intensive case management, also ACT teams, which are assertive community treatment teams, especially in the area of supported housing, and they wanted us to look at maximizing Medicaid benefits. I mean, taking Medicaid benefits that might go for services, and then pairing those up with key general fund and federal funding to make a full package for people.
Medicaid funding for people who are in the state hospital. Is that correct?
Correct. That is correct.
So it really behooves the state, when we're looking at financial issues, it behooves the state to make sure that people are in the community with supported services that could be partially funded by Medicaid, right?
Representative May and the committee, yes, I believe that is correct, that it is. We will always need acute care situations and chronic care, but it is very important that people who can be in the community are in the community, not just, you know, obviously for their own health and wellness, and also it makes sense fiscally. So we had made big investments in the crisis system. We've added 9 ACT teams, including something that's going to be unique, which is a FACT team. It's a forensic assertive community team. It's for people who have had this interface with the criminal justice system, and this team will specialize in caring for those people. Each ACT team has about 100 clients, no more, and as I think we've discussed before, the ACT teams are made up of a psychiatrist, nurse, social worker, peer support. It's a very prescribed team, and it goes to people's homes, to McDonald's, to the car wash where they work. It's a team that does outreach. And
how many teams do we have?
We have approximately 20 teams that are either running or becoming up and running in Oregon, and we work with the Center of Excellence for these teams to reach fidelity. We use the Dartmouth model to make sure that, because it is an evidence-based practice, to make sure that it's maximizing its effectiveness by adhering to the models. We are in the process of making sure that every team meets those standards. If not, then they may be thinking about converting their work into a intensive case management. So,
Greg will be at the next panel to talk with us about the population in the hospital. So has all of this worked to minimize the number of people in the hospital?
I think that the number of beds in the hospital is going to stay the same in terms of the number of people who are hospitalized. I think what will happen is that the length of stay will be shorter, and that the discharge planning will be swifter and get people out. So, as
not happening yet, though.
It has happened in some areas. There obviously is a lot of progress to be made, but the one thing that has happened with the Aim High program, which helps to place people in the community, is that from the point in time when a person was deemed by their treatment team to be ready for placement to the time of when they're actually in their placement has gone down by over half. So I'm ready to go, and instead of waiting, you know, a certain number of days, I wait about half of that time. So that's been successful. We are working with Greg and his team on the making sure that people get in more quickly from acute care, that they're working on getting the length of stay shorter, and that is very dependent on these community services that we have, especially supported housing. So
So how is the progress in supportive housing?
Well,
the letter you got from the USDOJ, as I recall, was early January, and you were going to be doing quarterly reports. Is that correct?
Yes.
So there should have been a couple, almost, you're close to the second quarterly report.
Yes.
What are you letting them know, what your progress is?
Well, we had meetings in March as well. So we had meetings in January and then meetings in March. And USDOJ again, in the letter, state that they are encouraged by the commitments and the presentations that we made is consistent with their vision for Oregon. And they felt that at this point, our data collection was at a point where it's going to start to give us the information that we were looking for. Our data collection system for the non-Medicaid funding now has 14,000 consumers enrolled, and over 500 providers have been trained. So what this will do is the Medicaid data system and this data system looking at general funds and the federal funds will be able to be married. So now we will have a better look at the system.
One of the issues has been, as I recall from the letter from the DOJ, is that the CCOs, there needs to be more of an agreement among the CCOs between your office and certainly the criminal justice system about who's taking responsibility for some of these people to keep them out of the hospital. They're in the hospital, getting them out as quickly as possible, which includes, of course, services through the healthcare system. So how is that going, Pam?
Representative Tomei and members of the committee, I think it's going well. We have a behavioral health director CCO meeting monthly. That group is, working well together on these issues. We're working with the County of Multnomah to, for example, to look at the entire array of crisis system services in that county. We've put more funding into crisis services and jail diversion, and also have significant projects underway to increase the amount of supported housing across the state. There are three major initiatives that we are part of to increase the amount of housing. As you all know, the vacancy rates are extremely low across the state, and this is a time when our goal is to place people in, specifically in community settings with supports, for that to be, you know, a life in the community, a permanent home for people. We would like to see people move more quickly from higher levels of care, such as secure facilities or unsecure facilities, into the community. And all of the funding that has gone into the adult system is all pretty much designed with that in mind. The ACT teams, increases in peer supports. These are things that we will be reporting out to everyone in September when these programs have had a chance to get up and running. So I think we have fulfilled year one and two, which is identifying the gaps, and the next steps are to continue the quarterly meetings. We are also doing a statewide strategic planning. We've had two town hall meetings. There are four more scheduled, as well as a tribal consultation and an after-hours webinar for people who work. So we'll be presenting a draft two-year strategic plan, which will include the Olmstead planning in August. And we also, the other thing that USDOJ and all of us were interested in doing was increasing consumer voice. So we have, we are now this week interviewing for the director of the Office of Consumer Affairs at Addictions and Mental Health, and that person will be on our executive team, and we're really looking forward to that. So that was my planned
Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.
We invited Representative Greenlick to join us today because he's dealing with, the Health Committee. And so I'm certainly open to any kind of feedback from you, Representative. We talked about the CCOs taking more responsibility for mental health as well as physical health. So do you have any?
I very much appreciate you inviting me. We had a session in the Health Committee yesterday on the CCOs and their integration with mental health. And my impression was that it worked effectively in those places where it works, and we didn't hear much from those places where I'm pretty sure it's not working very well. But the point you raised about the responsibility for patients in the state hospital is one that I think we really, I mean, it is not in their financial interest to move people out of the state hospital and take responsibility for a chronically mentally ill person. It is in their health care, and there are some of the some of the quality outcomes that they're being reimbursed for that include integration of mental health services. So there's hope, but I don't think it's coming. The push isn't coming yet from the outside. It's something we're going to continue to keep the pressure on.
And I want to keep reminding the committee and the audience that it costs $333,000 every year to keep one patient in the hospital. So when we look at a time of fiscal restraints, I mean, number one, it's not healthy for the patients. I think almost everybody recognizes that. A hospital is a place we go to get well, not to live the rest of our lives or even for years. So we want to keep that in the front of our consciousness so we can help people get out of the hospital and also to keep them out before they come in. And I know we have several of the questions, and I've sort of dominated this. Representative Whitsitt, thank you.
Thank you. We were just told in Klamath County alone, the CCO, they're getting between 400 and 500 billable mental health procedures or appointments per day under our CCO plan. And they're just overwhelmed. This is in a community of 66,000 people. So if you figure that out, it's 125,000 mental health visits under the CCO. We also have the highest commitment to the state hospital from this county per capita in the state. And so these parts of rural Oregon are in desperate need of emergency facilities for housing, whatever we can get. We don't even have an emergency facility. They have to haul the people to the hospital, and there, you know, it's $2,000 a night. So I think it's really important that we understand it isn't just Multnomah County. These rural parts of Oregon are just being devastated by drugs and alcohol addiction problems primarily.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, I wanted to thank Dr. Martin for your presentation. I have a question that might get answered later on today with some other presenters. I first of all want to say that I think that Washington County is particularly appreciative of the mental health support that it's gotten, and the response teams that have been developed with the social workers and so on have been very well received. My question, though, has come to me or comes from a constituent who's concerned about regulation, and particularly with regard to residential care, and apparently there's some questionable licensing kind of issues that are coming up. And my question really has to do more with as we achieve greater parity with regard to mental health and the Oregon Health Authority, can we anticipate similar kinds of surveys being done of some of these residential facilities that we have within the health system? And I guess part of that question also is, do we have sufficient staff? Do you have sufficient staff to do that kind of survey work, the kind of monitoring that's needed to sort of regulate? And what we're getting at really is the whole issue of adequate, affordable, supportive housing kinds of issues.
So, Representative May and members of the committee, to date, our regulatory arm is, I think, is well staffed, and they're getting their jobs done. If we were to increase oversight, that we would have to look at that again. In terms of the constituent issue, if you could point that person towards me, we can try to address their specific issue.
Great. We'll do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pam. Julia, thanks so much for coming today. One of the reasons that we've invited you here is that we know that the PSRB patients, often very difficult to place them in the community. So in the past, we've learned that there just weren't enough homes, and so sometimes people would be waiting a year or more before they could be placed. So can you talk about the adequacy of homes to help people get out of the hospital?
Yes. Representative Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Juliet Follinsby. I'm the director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We supervise those that have successfully asserted the insanity defense, often referred to as GEI clients. We do not supervise the AIM High clients that you're probably going to hear about today, nor do we supervise the 370 clients. So these are clients that have committed more than likely an A or B felony, that typically start their initial stay under our jurisdiction at the state hospital. So as Representative Tomei mentioned, historically, our clients have been harder to place in the community. That, though, has changed in the last several bienniums. This legislature has funded a continuum of care in the community, starting with secure facilities. So secure facilities didn't exist over 10 years ago. And so now we're able to place some of these harder to manage clients in a secure setting, which is, of course, freeing up beds at the state hospital. And also the new development has focused on specialty small residential homes that can address specific needs of maybe somebody has a traumatic brain injury. So, for instance, we have a TBI, a traumatic brain injury home now, medically enhanced facility. Those were individuals that traditionally, before these community services existed, had to languish in the hospital, and that certainly has been a positive development. Also, this legislature has funded the community mental health agencies so they can provide that supervision and monitoring that Representative Gallegos was referring to. All of our clients have the ability to take up a bed at any of those residential levels. So some of our clients are at the secure facility. Some of our clients can easily be managed in an independent setting where we would need staff that are adequately funded to do those home checks to ensure the client remains stable. And I think that's in line with the Olmstead and what Dr. Martin was talking about. Is the trend is to develop these ACT, or we call it intensive case management, ICM programs, where our clients are able to leave the group home setting and live in their own apartment, yet not have public safety or their mental health jeopardized, where we're having the staff come to them on a daily basis. So I think we're seeing, especially since 2009, we have the highest number of clients out on conditional release than we ever have. So we have 385 clients out on conditional release right now. I think that speaks to the development that Pam was talking about. It's imperative, obviously, that the board hopes that the legislature continues to fund the existing resources that we have, and then, of course, existing the funding. We are seeing some languishing at the residential license facility, and I think the supported housing and rental assistance resources are going to help move our clients to those lower levels of care. Most of our clients are Medicaid eligible and don't have the resources to just go out and get an apartment. They also have a criminal history or maybe a sex offender status that is a barrier to renting their own apartment. And these programs that Dr. Martin talked about, I think, will facilitate our clients being able to move to these lower levels of care at a faster speed without those barriers. There's also master lease programs that Addictions and Mental Health has invested in, which helps.
Master lease.
So the state actually has the lease for the apartments, and then they sublet to our clients who have a difficult time getting apartments on the fair market value or the fair market.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has helped kind of move our clients through that lower continuum, and that frees up beds then, so our clients that are at the hospital ready to place in the community can then go into those freed residential beds. So we hope that that funding continues and hope to see this trend continue of most of our clients residing outside of the hospital.
And how many are in the hospital?
We have 163, and SHARP, the State Hospital Review Panel, has 93. So we have 256 GEI clients in the hospital, approximately. 385 GEI clients are out in the community. I think it's important to maintain these various levels of services in the community because it allows our board to minimize the need to revoke somebody back to the state hospital. So, for instance, somebody's living maybe independently or semi-independently, starts to get symptomatic and decompensates. If there's a respite bed, a crisis bed, or a secure bed, we can step them up instead of having to revoke to the state hospital. And I think you see that in our revocation rates that are going down. So continuing to allow us the most flexibility with the various levels of care, I think, will help that.
That's great.
Yeah.
So how many people are ready to leave the hospital?
We have approximately 10 clients that are ready to leave. That being said, many of them have been offered beds and been accepted for placement, and they have refused. And whether it's because it's a not good fit, anxiousness, mental health symptoms often are barriers. And I know that the hospital is diligently working with those clients to maybe do site visits in the community to have a longer transitional period to encourage this client or clients to move into the community. We have, for some of our clients with their special needs, for instance, you know, if you have a traumatic brain injury, you're going to go to the traumatic brain injury community placement. So if there's not a bed available necessarily right now, those individuals might be delayed. But again, we're working hard to kind of move the clients that are already in the community down in levels of care so it can free up the bed for those clients. But there's not many. I mean, we have right now, you know, at almost every level of care, a bed available for a client if they so choose.
That's great.
Yes. It may not be in the community they want. You know, that's the challenge.
Yeah,
that's
right.
The balance. We can't have all of these facilities in every single county. And the
what
board
is the longest that a patient might be there in the hospital ready to leave and
you know, that's so hard to answer. That really does vary.
But currently right now.
Currently, right now, you know, if it's a client that is willing to take the next available bed, there's a bed right now. So,
I just remember people being there over a year, ready to leave, and not
we have not seen that in the last year
great,
and a half.
Perfect.
We have not seen that.
I'm glad to hear that, Representative Greenlick.
Could you talk a little bit more about the declining revocation rates? That's a pretty important issue, isn't it?
Absolutely, Representative Tomei. Representative Greenlick, the more services that are available in the community, the more likely a community provider can maintain a client in the community, and that's directly related to the revocation rate. So, for instance, we had several secure vacant beds this past summer, and you know, we routinely use those beds to step clients into temporarily and sometimes for longer periods if they needed it, instead of revoking. And so sometimes a client might relapse on drugs and alcohol. We might, instead of revoking them, we would then put them in an intensive substance abuse treatment program. If it was a client who needed a medication adjustment, Perhaps we would put them in a secure facility where there's a 24/7 nurse and more frequent access to a psychiatrist so that medication adjustment could be done in a safe manner. You know, certainly having all of those resources available. Sometimes for some clients, maybe we would just have to step them up from a semi-independent into a residential home. So, you know, depending on the needs of the client, we kind of run the gamut on
follow-up.
How are the rates? I mean, what are the rates? How have they changed over the last year or two?
So we have about the same number of clients in the last year. The last 2 years, and I believe we had 22 less revocations in 2013 than we did in 2012.
Isn't the revocation rate, as I remember it, was 2% or less?
That's the recidivism rate, Representative
Tomei.
Thank you. The recidivism rate is the rate at which our clients reoffend, and that is 2%. But the revocation rate, that's when the board orders the client return to the state hospital. The raw numbers, we've had the same amount of clients in 2012 and 13, and we had less revocations last year, partly in due, in fact, that, you know, that we had these community resources that we could step our clients up.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. You're welcome. Glad to hear it.
Tell us those numbers in terms of percentage. The revocation.
I have to follow up for the percentage. I will absolutely follow up with you and get you that.
And get that information to the committee staff, please.
Absolutely.
And give it to all of us. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I had a question for Mrs. Martin, Director Martin. Okay.
Sure.
Thank you. Director Martin, the DOJ reports and your response, is that available to the public?
Yes, it is. Those are public documents.
We had sent them to your representative.
Well, I wanted to be sure the public, because I trust someone like Bob or someone to do more investigative than they think. So, good.
But you've gotten those a couple of times, so we'll make sure it comes out again.
Thank you. And one quick question.
They're on OLIS, right, as we speak. Go ahead.
Got a question, Madam Chair.
Sure.
The Office of Consumer Affairs, can you briefly, a couple sentences, what's the responsibility of this position?
Yes, Representative Tomei and Representative Winslow, the committees. It's the broad goal of this is to have consumer voice at the executive levels and also to work with our different consumer advisory groups to make sure that that voice is heard when we look at policy directions. I also anticipate that this Office of Consumer Activities or Affairs will work on efforts to destigmatize mental illness and substance abuse issues with organizations across the state, and will probably be involved in technical assistance to organizations around mental health first aid and other available training to raise the awareness and the a sense of connection to communities, to individuals in their communities who struggle with mental illness.
Madam Chair, it's a clarification. And I know people up here, one of our big issues is where you site them, and you've talked about that, and that's a continued problem where you site the homes and the communities, and that person would be looking at that too.
Representative Wilson, I think that'd be a great use of their time and energy to work on that particular issue, which is part of the stigmatization problem.
Thank you.
And it's federal law that we can't discriminate against having a home for mentally ill.
State and federal law both.
Okay. Thank you both. So go ahead, gentlemen.
Representative Tomei and committee members, my name is Tim Mahoney. My career in community mental health and residential spans four decades. That's really hard to say. I've served as a community mental health director for 27 years. I've served as an interim director in two different counties. And currently I am a residential services director for Lifeways, which covers two counties, Umatilla and Mount Huer. My perspective is very rural, suffice it to say, and I believe I was asked to present about what community and residential services could be enhanced to improve the services in communities. I also oversee a 16-bed secure acute residential facility in Umatilla, Oregon. So when Ms. Follinsby says some folks don't want to come out to certain places in the community, I can attest that when you look at Umatilla, Oregon, it may not be your favorite place to come to. So we do a lot of marketing and effort. We have some hybrid services out in that I oversee, and so one of those is McNary Place. We have 10 PSRB clients there in a secure setting, and we also have 4 acute beds. When BMRC lost their Medicaid match, Blue Mountain Recovery Center, when they lost their match, there was a need in Eastern Oregon, of course, for acute capacity. So we have a separate unit. We have the ability to provide that services, and we've provided 400 admissions since 2007. We also have mention of Aim High. We have 2 long-term beds. So we've had very few revocations, but one thing that would improve services, in my opinion, for PSRB is on 2 tracks. One, we have a unit. We're looking right across from it in a bubble, if you will, with a command station fully staffed with professional folks. And we might have an acute situation with one of those 400 admissions that we've had over the past 7 years, and we can do a med override or dual-cause medications because the person has decompensated. Those stays are relatively short. Ironically, if we have somebody, as Ms. Follinsby mentioned, that may decompensate on the PSRB side, choose not to take their medications. I've watched 3 or 4 of these situations where, frankly, if we could have administered medication against the resident's wishes, thank you, I think we would have mitigated the need to have the revocation, and the person would stabilize. The advent of the neuroleptic medications that access the patient and get them to respond in a more rapid fashion is one of the things that I've witnessed over my long career. The medications are just so much better, so much more fast-acting and effective. So that's a statute that that's by statute that they have to come back to the state hospital to get the medication override, and it's unfortunate. I don't know if Mr. McChesney has witnessed that in the programs that he oversees, but we've had that experience. Also, I think we've been able to accommodate some of these crises from other places for PSRB that are in the community, but to improve the system, there's not always a crisis respite bed available for PSRB population. And once they get back into the system and go back to Oregon State Hospital, it's a lengthy and costly process. And on an efficiency component, if there was just a couple of dedicated beds throughout the state, and Hague, maybe even in Umatilla, we're only 3 hours from Portland, I think that you could reduce the revocations and give better quality of care to the PSRB population.
I'm going to stop you right there. So, please. Juliet, let me ask you then, so what about those beds? Why can't those be provided so that somebody doesn't have to go back in the hospital? We know when they go to the hospital, you have to go through this whole big process, and you're going to be there a long time,
right?
Not just a few days until you stabilize.
So, Representative Tomei, so currently when we step somebody up in lieu of revocation, it is dependent on do they happen to have a vacant bed. So there are not currently, I think, designated respite beds.
Anywhere? Just not in his area?
Not at his facility necessarily. There are certainly respite facilities that we have utilized. In the rural areas, we have Sequoia, I guess, in eastern Oregon. What we find in the Portland area, in those cases, we would often attempt to use the local locked mental ward, so the OHSU, for instance. We've done medication adjustments there. Providence has also a program that can house the short term. We have some community hospitals, though, that don't have the resources to do that, and we find that in those counties that there it increases the chance of revocation. So, for instance, I'm thinking on our coast, or you know, Coos County, we don't have the resources to maintain a client there in a locked hospital setting, so those clients would be more inclined to have to be revoked. Versus if they're placed in another area.
So is that something that's being looked at so that there can be more respite places where people can go who are decompensating? Anybody?
Okay, Representative May and members of the committee, that's absolutely being looked at. One of our, the funding that we're co-managing with NAMI and ORPA, and $4 million of it is going into, looks like it's going to be directed towards new construction and development of affordable housing, but I believe $1 million of it is going to be dedicated to developing respite care. It is a gap and a need in our system to have more of that kind of capability.
It's so interesting and discouraging to me. It seems like we can always find money to spend in the state hospital, but it's hard to find money for these kinds of common sense kind of solutions. So it's something I want us to keep thinking about and talking about. So let's talk about it again in September when we meet also. Representative Whitson.
Thank you. Could somebody figure out and let me know what the cost to bring a decompensated patient back to the state hospital is from an area like Klamath or over at Umatilla? We have a vehicle. We have, I assume, a couple of personnel. We're going to be overnight. Just the cost to move them 5 to 7 hours one direction to the state hospital, that would be really beneficial. We're figuring out, what is the cost of putting something into a community versus hauling these people, the patients, back up to the state hospital? I mean, that's something we need to consider, too.
Yeah, and, of course, Medicaid money cannot be used for this. This is all state money. Does anybody else have a question? Thank you. Was there any concluding comments you'd like to make?
If I may, just real quickly, Dr. Martin mentioned AIM High funding. As I mentioned, in the secure facility, we have 16 beds. Two of those are dedicated to AIM High. We have a wait list of six people that are ready to place. There's a lack of funding, if I understand the matrix and the model correctly. So we don't have the capacity. We don't have a vacancy. But people get hung up a lot in other secure settings for an opportunity to get placed with AIM High. So if there were more funds, my company, LifeWays, would certainly look at the prospect of increasing capacity. And I'd like to mention that in Hermiston, Oregon, we are building a 10-bed acute facility in partnership with the local hospital in an attempt to deliver services to the acute population in eastern Oregon. It's not uncommon for us not to have an available bed for those four acute beds. And then I'd like to mention that in Washington State, people get hung up in the emergency rooms all the time. I've done thousands of crises, interventions, and been in lots of emergency rooms over the years, and thousands is not an overestimation. I wish I would have kept count. Many of those people have alcohol and drug problems, and so in my opinion, they're the most difficult to place. They're still actively under the influence of chemicals, and in Washington State, they have the capacity on a short-term basis to go ahead and exercise involuntary civil commitments. I'm not that familiar with the model, but they do have that capacity. Oregon does not have that capability. And again, this is a population very difficult to place in, needs to have.
A difficult issue, not one we're going to be dealing with today, but
thank you
for testifying. You bet. Kevin, nice to see you again.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Kevin McChesney, and I am the current president of the Oregon Residential Providers Association. And that gives me an opportunity, really, to to talk regularly with providers around the state, and even though our organization is specifically for residential providers, most of those providers are more full service and provide other kinds of services. So it gave me the opportunity to really poll them with that question: as we move forward, what do we need to? What are priorities for future spending and for development of services? And some of them have already been mentioned. Respite services, particularly respite services combined with peer-delivered services, are really an inexpensive way to maintain people in the community. And, you know, we see broad swatches of the state where that service is not available. And it can be scaled really to the size of a community's need. As Dr. Martin mentioned, we are putting aside some of that $5 million in money specifically for respite, because that was apparent that, particularly from NAMI, that that's a very definite need. I think one of the things that I'm hearing pretty regularly about is that with the expansion of Medicaid, on top of really what's been an underfunded infrastructure in outpatient services, that it's, you know, it's great that people have insurance now, but we are seeing extended waits, particularly for individuals to see prescribers. So that wait can be several months in many cases. So, you know, we definitely, that infrastructure development is lagging, and that really needs to have some attention paid to it. Likewise, I think from a residential perspective, one of the things we're seeing, a lot of the development of residential services began in the mid-90s, about the time that Damage State Hospital closed. And because many of those programs that opened at that time and since, they have not received regular cost of living increases, and yet costs continue to go up. And so we're now faced with situations where really those, it's going to be a matter of years probably, but some of those programs, unless that situation's addressed, will no longer be financially viable. And we may actually see the closure of some residential programs or the repurposing of them. So that's a continued concern at this point. Jail diversion is another huge issue. Multnomah County is putting some seed money into a jail diversion program, but my employer happens to operate the Crisis Assessment Treatment Center, and it's actually going to take two beds out of service, essentially, to try and keep people from staying in jail because they've committed a minor crime and have a mental illness. But we don't really have two empty beds any longer in that program, so it's actually taking away some of the general crisis capacity to try and serve that population. So
we'll be hearing more about that in the next panel. We're also going to be talking about that in the Judiciary Committee, about the 370s people being sent to the hospital.
And I certainly don't want to dwell on that, but I agree that community services for that 370 population
these are the aid and
is essential.
Mm-hmm. Committee, the people who have committed a crime and it's determined that they're not able to assist in their own defense, and so then they're too often sent to the state hospital, which is a huge program.
And then there are subsets of the population that really are either difficult to serve or underserved, and those include people with traumatic brain injuries, mm-hmm. where they sort of get caught between both systems. Mm-hmm. They're not easily moved into APD, and they're not well served by the mental health system as well, and so they're sort of a football. Another population like that are also people who are duly diagnosed with developmental disabilities and a mental illness. Same kind of situation. I think really those are the major issues. Obviously, homelessness and housing continue to be issues, and I think we're going to make a dent in that. But again, I've heard a expert in housing say that we're about 100,000 units short of adequate housing for low-income and people with disabilities in the state of Oregon. So that's really a very large hole.
Our Representative Gallegos has been our key person in dealing with housing needs, so that might be a connection the two of you want to make.
And then if I may, one more issue. I think, again, scalable to community size, but we need more crisis, either resolution centers or some sort of crisis stabilization units. And we need alternatives for people experiencing behavioral health crises to emergency departments, because that still remains the most costly and yet the easiest way to get services.
And that was certainly one of the issues that the USDOJ kept talking about and pointing out. So we're certainly aware of that. We need to do something about it, not just talk about it, not just study it. Let's do something about it. So thank you all for coming, and we'll be talking about some of these issues again in September until we get it right. So thank you so much for coming. Thanks for your input. So we will close the update on the mental health system and open up the informational meeting on the increase in Oregon's aid and assist population. Greg Roberts, superintendent of the state hospital. Pam is going to stay on with us. Roderick Calkins from Marion County Mental Health, and Cheryl Ramirez. Hi, Cheryl. And Jason Meyer, Sheriff. Good to see you again. Okay, we're going to double up here, folks. Thank you. Because, as you can see, sometimes we go back and forth, so I appreciate you being willing to do this. Who's going to do are you going to do one of these?
Real quick.
Okay, real quick.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. For the record, I'm Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, and I'm here this morning to speak about the 370 population. That's the statute that applies to people who are arrested for a crime, a felony or a misdemeanor, and about whom there's a question about their ability to aid and assist in their defense, or who have already been determined to be unable to aid and assist in their defense, and they come to the state hospital for restorative services. In layman's terms, a restoration to competency. In legal terms, a restoration to the ability to aid and assist in their defense. So, I don't know which button to hit. Oh, never mind. There you go. All right. Next slide. I'm providing this information to make a particular point. Patients who are, when a court order is signed to send the patient to the hospital as a 370 patient, we must admit that person within 7 days of the court order being signed. That's based on a statute or a case from some years ago called the Mink case. So it prevents people from languishing in jail when obviously they need mental health services. So the goal for treatment for a 370 patient in the hospital is simply to restore them to competency, to restore them to the ability to aid and assist in their defense. So from a certain point of view, the 370 patient is not in the state hospital to receive the spectrum of services that other patients would receive on a longer length of stay. We're focused entirely on the ability to aid and assist in their defense. So the primary treatment goals are stabilization, focusing on the ability to cooperate with their attorneys and participate in their defense. These patients do go to our treatment malls. They are served on their units by treatment teams. At the current time, we have 8 discrete units in the hospital for 370 patients, and today we have about 150 such patients in the hospital. The examples of programs that the 370 patients participate in are about legal skills. They have access to the law library. They receive legal assistance. And, of course, medication management has been mentioned. Once a person is in the hospital as a 370 patient, their first evaluation as to their ability to aid and assist takes place within 30 days of admission. Sometimes it takes place sooner, depending on the recommendation of the treatment team, and then 90 days thereafter and every 180 days thereafter. We have a team of certified evaluators in what we call our Forensic Evaluation Services Department, and the treatment teams, when the treatment team on the unit believes that the person now may be able to aid and assist in their defense, that patient is referred to our Forensic Evaluation Services, where we have the certified examiners who basically serve as a double check on the team's opinion. And then we proceed from there. The evaluator can determine, there are 3 options. The evaluators may determine that the person is able to now aid and assist. They're competent to stand trial. That person is then returned to jail and their legal proceedings move forward. Or the evaluator may determine that the person is not yet able, meaning we believe they will become able at some point, but at this point they are not yet ready, and that person would remain at Oregon State Hospital. And then the third option is that the person will never be able to gain the ability to aid and assist in their defense. There is a 3-year time limit on that status. If a person is never able for a 3-year period, then the case returns to the court system for determination. At that point, the court may dismiss the charges against the person and order that the patient be discharged, or they can initiate civil commitment proceedings. But I need to tell you that in the past year, of 389 370 discharges from the hospital, only 9 return to the hospital as civil commits. That's 2.3%. So it's not a high percentage of people who are declared never able return to the hospital as an involuntary civil commitment. Okay. Currently, the range is 20 to 25% of the patients at any one time at the hospital are 370 patients, but they constitute, and we'll see this data shortly, they constitute 2/3 of the admission to the hospital in a calendar year.
I want you to understand that. Could you say that again? That's
two-thirds.
Sort of an astounding
of all number. The people admitted to the hospital in a year, 2/3 came as 370 patients. And that's been a steadily increasing figure for us. And I can interject at this point, the previous panel was a perfect prelude to what we're discussing. There's been very good progress at the hospital in the past few years on the reduction of the guilty except for insanity population. We have been able to accommodate our civil population without growing the wait list for civil patients. And we reduced our geriatric population, enabling us to actually close one of our geriatric units in the past year. So, but the increase in the 370 population has offset the gains in the GEI civil and geriatric population.
Just a second. Representative Greenlick, you and I were on a group that was looking at the state hospital trying to decrease the population. There was never, as I recall, any kind of hint that this would be the population that would be growing. Is that your memory also?
Yeah, these numbers just stun me.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
What's going on?
We're going to hear more, but let me, if I can, let me let Representative Gelser ask a question, and then we'll figure that out.
Within that 370 population, do you have a breakdown of who those individuals are and what percentage of those are duly diagnosed with an intellectual or developmental disability?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gelser, I can get that data. I don't have it. We do have that data, and I can get that for you. I don't believe it's a high percentage, but I think there's some percentage within it.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I lost a piece. The 77% that passed an evaluation, this is after a certain period of time? What does that mean, that they passed their evaluation?
Representative Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, that would mean that they were declared able to aid and assist.
After 30 days or 60 days? Or
The median length of stay for 370 patients is 70 days. Uh-huh. The average length of stay is about 170 days.
So follow-up. If yes. They don't pass, they just continue to stay?
If they do not pass their evaluation declared able to aid and assist, they may stay in the hospital if we believe they will at some point be able to be restored to the ability to aid and assist. But if they're declared never able, if we believe they never will be able, then we report that to the courts, and the courts proceed at that point, either to dismiss the charges or to civilly commit the person. Okay. But a high percentage of people do become able to aid and assist.
Commit to the hospital?
Yes. But very few do. That was my point. Only 2% come back as civil commits.
Representative Greenlake, your question was, how did this happen?
Why has there been a change in the admission? Is it that statute that we passed in 2011?
Representative Tomei, Representative Greenlake, and members of the committee, that's the question we're looking at. And at this point, we have more questions than answers to that. But to jump around the slides a little bit, 60%, and the issue actually that is, I think, most on the table this morning is that 40% of all, let me repeat, 2/3 of all the admissions to the state hospital last year and this year have been 370s. Okay. 40% of them are misdemeanors. And there's where we're seeing.
Sorry, are what?
Misdemeanors. They're for low-level offenses. 60% are felonies, 40% are misdemeanors.
And that has changed over the years,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Talk some about that.
That's where we're focusing the question to determine what's behind that movement and why is that happening.
Can you give an example of a misdemeanor that might send someone to the state hospital?
Criminal mischief, maybe a contempt of court. I have a list of the charges here. Public urination.
Public urination?
That would be sort of a disturbing legal charge. That
okay, I guess we'll hear from the rest of the panel.
Lead to. I have a list of some
rural communities.
Yeah, that's a pretty common thing.
I'll find out. Could be failure to appear in court, that type of thing.
So fascinating. Okay, Representative Gelser has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the public urination brought up a question I've always wondered about. For some of these folks that come in, how often is that length of stay determining whether or not the person is able to aid and assist longer than the term that they would serve if they were convicted of the crime?
Mm-hmm. Representative Senator Tomei, Representative Gelser, no, the limit, the maximum sentence for the crime, it sets the limit for the time a person can be a 370. So a person would never be in the hospital as a 370 patient for a longer period of time than they would have served in jail for that. I found my list. Public indecency, disorderly conduct, harassment, public indecency, menacing, intimidation, interfering with a police officer. There are some of the misdemeanor charges.
What would be the least amount of time that somebody coming in under a 370, the least amount of time they might be in the hospital?
Representative Tomei, I would say, I can get those figures on this slide. You would see, this is current population. I would say the least amount of time, probably about a month, by the time the treatment team evaluates the patient, recommends them to forensic evaluation, if they get a determination the person is able to aid and assist, especially if someone's malingering, if someone's found to be malingering, then they can be returned to the jail within a short period of time.
Thank you. Representative Whitson.
So, is there some particular aspect of a misdemeanor that would send someone to the state hospital? Because, I mean, they happen all over, all the time, basically. I mean, what aspect of it is that sends them on that path?
Representative Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, and members of the committee. The issue is the panel prior to this is hitting on the same theme. Quite a bit of this, and this is part of the answer to Representative Greenlich's question, has to do with the availability of community resources to provide the restoration services. So in the absence of community-based programs and services to help restore a person to the ability to aid and assist, then the only option becomes the state hospital. But
so are we referring primarily to under the influence of something?
Representative Whitsitt, I would say no. People have a mental illness diagnosis, not simply a substance abuse diagnosis.
Okay. Hmm.
Many of our patients have both mental illness and substance abuse.
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair.
So this is a follow-up to Representative Whitsitt's question. Again, thinking back to the list of the types of misdemeanors, there are many of those in our local communities where, due to a lack of resources, district attorneys aren't prosecuting them. People are cited and they're released. What is to protect people who may be living in the community with a mental illness or living in the community and people just are annoyed by having them there? What is to prevent a district attorney or police officer to use this 370 commitment hearing as a way to get people out of their community on a minor misdemeanor?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gelser, that's what would prevent that is the court process. A 370 requires a court order, so the local officials would need to take the case to court and convince the judge that the move to the state hospital was the appropriate alternative.
And put that up.
Mm-hmm.
But what would cause a DA to choose to take a person who was a substance abuser or mentally ill who publicly urinated on a city street and not take one of the college students in my community that is walking home from a party and does the same thing? They're not landing in the state hospital. I mean, nobody's going to a judge to ask for this 370 hearing. Do you understand the question?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gelser, members of the committee. What would I think the difference is the existence of a psychiatric diagnosis. A person has obvious mental illness and is engaging in behavior that leads to an arrest on these charges. And then that begins the process of review that ends up with a court review and a court order to come to the state hospital.
And just one more quick follow-up about that. And again, I know that you're not making this decision. It's out there in the community. But how is that not discriminatory, that if you are a person with a psychiatric diagnosis, urinating on the street can land you in the state hospital for a period of time in a lengthy and costly court process? And if you are not a person with a psychiatric disability, the officer will tell you, don't do that again, go home. How is that?
That's probably not the question correctly directed to Greg. Maybe some of these gentlemen can help us with that. We'll get back to you.
My guess would be that these are people who are fairly well known in their community as problematic because of their mental illness and therefore come into the system that way. One of the things to realize is that these people do not meet the involuntary commitment standard. I think if they did, they would be coming to the hospital as a civil committed person. But they're mentally ill, but they're not so dangerous by reason of their mental illness to meet the involuntary commitment standard, and therefore they become involved in the 370 process instead of the civil commitment. But that only 2% come back to us as civil commit after this would be an illustration of that.
The mental illness is not that serious that they have to be civilly committed.
Right.
And I think your point was, too, if there's nothing in the community that can help these people through a crisis, then we send them to a very, very, very expensive and lengthy stay in a state hospital. Representative Greenlich.
Can I try my stereotype out on this and see if this is what we're talking about? Because I find this quite disturbing. There are chronic schizophrenics who live in parks in Portland that I meet regularly who occasionally get into trouble because they've been mumbling or they got drunk as well as being schizophrenic, and they get charged with a stupid misdemeanor. They know those people are never going to be ready to assist in their defense, nor is anybody really seriously worried about what it is they've been charged with. I mean, it's my impression that those people charged with a misdemeanor get in the hospital simply because it becomes a part of the process. Otherwise, I mean, maybe they would be put in jail for 7 days or something. I just wondered, do we have to relook at that 370? I've not read that statute, but produce some criteria that screens them before they end up being in the state hospital, because everybody knows from the beginning they're not going to come out able to assist in a charge that's not worth putting them away in the first place. Is that stereotype right? Am I?
Representative Tomei, Representative Green, look, it's what you're describing is actually a national problem. I've shared with Representative Tomei some articles from around the country. This is part of the challenge. Some people refer to it as the criminalization of the mentally ill. These are people, as we said, who do not meet the involuntary commitment standard, who are in need, clearly in need of services in the community. And either those services don't exist, or they will not avail themselves of the services that do exist. And many find themselves arrested for a crime, sometimes misdemeanors, and then come into the state hospital as a result. So I don't know that I'd use the word stereotypical, but it is that that's the process that works for some people.
We're going to be hearing this also in Judiciary Committee tomorrow, so. Maybe we'll come up with something then. Representative Alyssa Geyer.
Thank you, Chair. Did these people, are they also subjected to the mandatory medication, the override? And thus, is that one of the reasons they get sent there, as opposed to community services that don't have that stabilization factor?
Representative Tomei, Representative Ken Geyer. They are subject to the informed consent involuntary medication process, so... It's possible that that's a factor.
Representative Gunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If we are only allowed to keep people for the amount of time that they would statutorily be held for the misdemeanor, how does that finite time period affect your ability to offer meaningful treatment?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gomberg, I haven't heard from our staff that that's an issue. There's one of the charts, one of the charts we've looked at already, where I think only a small percentage of people reached the point where they were still in the hospital when their end of jurisdiction occurred. But it looks in the high majority of cases they're in the hospital long enough to not have to face that difficulty.
One of the issues, too, that we've talked about in the advisory board is that these are some of the folks that are causing the most problems there, people who are being harmed, staff being harmed, or one patient harming another patient. Is that accurate?
Representative Tomei, that is accurate. The data on the patient aggression and seclusion and restraints is highest on our 370 units.
Correct.
This is the slide that really makes the point. It takes you from January 2010 till April 2014 and shows the rise. The top chart shows the rise in the numbers of 370 patients on the hospital census, and the lower chart shows the admission rate. So where in 2010 there were 88 370 patients in the hospital, there are now nearly double that number. So as I was saying earlier, the gains of the reduction of the GEI population, the civil population, and the geriatric population has been offset by the increase in the 370 population.
Very discouraging.
This next chart is a profile of the admissions for the last 12-month period. 52% felonies, 44% misdemeanors, 4% other, and I had to ask my staff what is other, and those are actually documentation errors or contempt of court, specifically contempt of court numbers. But it's generally 60-40 felony misdemeanor. And Representative Greenlick had asked about House Bill 3100. That bill did standardize psychiatric evaluation processes, but it did not require it. A judge may order a psychiatric evaluation, but is not required to order a psychiatric evaluation in order to send a person to the hospital as a 370 patient. And as Representative Tomei and I have been discussing, one could then be tempted to say, well, let's change the law to require an evaluation before they come in. But when we compared those patients who come in without an evaluation to those who do come in with an evaluation, there's no difference in the length of stay there. So even if we required a prior evaluation, psychiatric or psychologically, it may not make a difference in terms of the length of stay if people come into the hospital. House Bill 3100 also gave courts flexibility and control over where individuals are treated. And I'll come to that on the last point. And the court, according to the law, the House Bill 3100, courts may commit people to the state hospital only if they are a danger to themselves or others and the services and supports they need are not available in the community. And again, on the theme of the prior panel, that I would think is the essential point, that to the extent the services are not available in the community to help people be restored to the ability to aid and assist, then the state hospital becomes the option. So.
Thank you. That goes directly to what I was saying, I think, regarding Klamath County having such a high commitment to the state hospital. We don't have the support and services in our community, and so are you tracking this? I mean, I would think it would behoove the hospital to look and see why, you know, where these groups of people are coming from and what they don't have in their community, because it would be so much cheaper to build something in the community than to send them up to the state hospital.
I'm not sure that's Greg's responsibility.
Yeah.
Pam, can you respond to that?
The question, Representative Tomei and Representative Wizard, yes, I think we need to look at this county by county and understand completely why people are being. One of the things we had talked about was a mobile forensic evaluation team, and we had already realized that that would be great for the I-5 corridor, but there'll be some communities, unless we get our telehealth services much more robust, where it may, in fact, be necessary to transport people to get a high-level evaluation done, but that still would not necessarily need to be in a hospital setting. So, yes, we need to look at this regarding the needs of each specific community.
In terms of what are we doing about the problem, we have been engaged. When we saw this trend clearly last year, we have engaged in conversations with local law enforcement officials, people in the criminal justice system, county mental health directors, and others. And we created a work group in Marion County. Marion is one of the higher referring counties. And we're working very collaboratively with a group, which I think you'll hear about later in this presentation, to study the issue, to understand, as Representative Greenlick was asking, what's at the root of these and what are some of the things we could do to begin to address the issue. Because, frankly, this is an unsustainable trend. Mm-hmm. If the line were to continue to rise as we've seen it, every 6 months we would need to add a 370 unit to the state hospital, and we just don't have the ability to do that. But that's what's been happening over the past few years. So we do have a work group that's including the district attorney's office, people from the jail, the sheriff himself, mental health providers in Marion County, and we're studying the problem the issues there, to get a sense of what we may be able to do to resolve this issue. And then also, since House Bill 3100 contains the language that says a judge can send a person to the state hospital if the resources in the community, or send refer some of the resources in the community, then the question is about the resources in the community that could be funded and developed to prevent the need from sending the person to the hospital. So,
how much would it cost to develop a new unit? You said you'd have to develop a new if it continued at this rate. How much does it cost to have a unit at that?
Representative Tomei, I can get that figure as well. The cost, I don't know if I'm, I think it is the cost for a 370 patient in the hospital is about $20,000 to $25,000 a month. To open a unit, typically every unit has about 43 staff on it, and then of course you have related costs, food, medication, etc. So
$25,000 a month.
Yeah. Right.
Startling.
Third of a million a year.
Yeah. Right. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. I think we're going to move on to you, sir.
Here we finally understand.
Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Rod Calkins, and I'm the administrator at Marion County Health Department. The health department works closely with community agencies to serve individuals who are working with Aid and Assist, or 370. We work closely with the state hospital, the courts, and law enforcement. And what I want to do this morning is talk a little bit about what we have done to date, but also, as Dr. Roberts was talking about, kind of the early steps that the work group that we've formed for Marion County has been taking, and what kind of thoughts we've been having on that, and some of the problems we've been grappling with, because this is a very complex issue. Since 2007, Marion County has been engaged in an early pilot project to address the issue of overcrowding at the state hospital due to the 370 population. And we had some early encouraging success, and by 2010, where that slide that you saw started, actually our numbers had dropped down into single digits from where they had been before, which was higher. What we did was provided mental health case management for individuals in the justice system, and we made access to prescribing possible for those individuals who were in crisis. We developed some transitional housing, and we assisted people in applying for benefits. We also worked to transition people more quickly out of the state hospital and connect them with other community resources. Despite that, our numbers have risen sharply, as you saw on that slide, and Marion County is no exception to that, and oftentimes we actually exceed 20 people from single digits to 20 people. That's a huge increase. So we're currently working with a collaborative work group, and this involves all the parties involved in Aid and Assist in the community, including the courts and including the defense attorney, which is an important component of this. Thus far, our work group has identified a number of factors that make finding an effective solution quite difficult. And I said it's a complex issue, and I think hopefully I'll be able to highlight some of that. But we've also begun to identify some potential changes which will be useful to pilot or develop. So first off, Aid and Assist is a legal process, and that's usually initiated by the defense attorney. Community mental health does not have any authority within the court process to weigh in on whether that defense is appropriate or not. In fact, if we become too involved in the court process, it could be that we're starting to interfere with a person's defense that they have a right to. So it's very difficult to figure out how to partner here. And really the question for us is, how is our knowledge about the individual, how can that be brought to bear appropriately so that that individual has the best chance of being restored to fitness to stand trial? Once a person's determined unable to aid and assist in their own defense, the court can order the 370 and restorative treatment in the state hospital. But if the court determines that actually it is more appropriate that that person can be restored to competence within the community, the court can actually release that person and place conditions on that release, such as requiring the person to report to a community mental health program on a regular basis. So community restoration is possible. In 2013 in Marion County, we provided community restoration to 12 people. That's out of a total of about 79 people that were in the hospital on 370. And this year so far, in 2014, we've served 8 people in the community. Our joint work group has identified a need for a better process. Two questions. Determining whether an individual actually needs a hospital level of care or whether those supports ought to be available in the community, and, of course, whether they are. And then also, how do we match restorative services best with an individual's needs? So one of the things that we're thinking about is for people who are referred to the state hospital, we're exploring the idea of putting in place a screening process that will help answer those questions and some other ones that I'll get to. The issue of a community mental health evaluation was mentioned, and I want to say a few things about that. We recognize that that's an important piece of the process to have early on. In the past, as many as 50% of the individuals being sent to the state hospital on aid and assist have not had a community mental health evaluation prior to that determination being made. And while that percentage has increased recently, still 25% of the individuals are not having a community mental health evaluation before coming out. Why is that important? Why is it happening? Well, that we're looking at. And one of the things the work group's going to tackle is how do we make sure there's an appropriate consultation about a person's mental state before a 370 order, which requires a mental health involvement, actually gets issued by the court. And we've made real progress on that in terms of some specific instances, in terms of working with specific judges. The issue is going to be broadening that out so that the court system as a whole, the different courts in which cases are being heard, actually are all acting in the same way and understanding that there needs to be some understanding of what the person's mental state is and how that contributes to their ability to aid or assist or inability. So what we're looking for is, if the question I think I want to address is, if it doesn't make any difference in length of stay, why do we need to be worried about whether there's a mental health evaluation or not? Well, we've looked at a number of the evaluations, and really we need to assess better for the contributions of substance abuse and also malingering. Some of the evaluations we've looked at have said, this person's malingering. They're dangerous. They really should go to the state hospital. But those reports do not cite any evidence of a mental health issue.
Yes, Representative Kenny.
What is malingering?
Malingering is faking a problem. So they are actually faking? Pretending to be ill. And that does not qualify as a mental health diagnosis. Therefore, in those few reports we've looked at, there's not evidence that really would support sending that person to the state hospital or even community restoration, because 370, that's not the intent of the statute as we're looking at it as a work group. So we really have to clean that up. And that's the reason
why we
being this work group. And I think it involves, you have to involve the courts and the defense attorney and the DA as well as mental health, because while Forensic evaluators are available in the community. While we have a jail mental health person that that knows about people who are coming to the court, the issue is making sure that those mental health issues get brought before the court so the best decision can be made about what's going on with the person and how to proceed.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
The issue that Greg raised about the fact that there's the same average length of stay among those who have been evaluated and those that haven't, I think, isn't the primary issue. The question is, how many of those people who have been pre-evaluated do not end up in the state hospital? I mean, their length of stay is zero, and you're not including those. So the question is, does pre-evaluation weed people out of the 370 process? And I wonder how many of them are not admitted who are pre-evaluated as opposed to those who are admitted without being pre-evaluated.
Representative Tomei, Representative Greenlake, if I understand the question, it has to do with if there's an evaluation and somebody is found not to have a mental health condition
or not to be appropriate
for an aid and assist defense, how many people get weeded out? I don't know.
Not get into the state hospital. So if there's, let's say, 25% of the people who are evaluated don't end up in the state hospital, you wouldn't want to push for everybody to be pre-evaluated because those that aren't automatically end up there, right?
And maybe that is something that your work group can find out.
So I think that's kind of my comments. I did want to say one more thing, and I think we have a lot of ideas about how to proceed. In the handout I produced, there's some summaries of some of those ideas for your reference. But the thing I want to underscore most is that the most important change here is that we are working together on this, that we're all in the same room, and that we're committed to finding a solution to making this better.
And you have judges also involved in this work
group?
Yes. Perfect. Good. Thank you. Okay, Jason, thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jason Myers, Marion County Sheriff, and I'm a part of this work group. I'm very encouraged by the conversation and the thought process and the ideas we're coming up with, and hopeful that we can help address this problem. But I'm going to actually talk about what we're doing on the front end of law enforcement to divert folks from going into custody at the jail. There's a lot of good work going on out in our community, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. In Marion County, we kind of found as our foundation is crisis intervention training for our law enforcement officials. We started that training at the Sheriff's Office, providing it to all law enforcement agencies in our county back in 2005. We've continued to offer that training on a bi-yearly basis. It's the 40-hour Memphis model, and it's really aimed at identification, identifying when somebody's in crisis, de-escalating the situation, and then, if possible, referring them to resources outside of taking them into custody. So that really started our foundation. We built upon that by establishing a memorandum of understanding with all the law enforcement agencies in Marion County to utilize services like our psychiatric crisis center, which is open 24 hours a day. When somebody comes into contact with somebody that's in crisis, instead of just arresting them if they've committed a crime, look at cite and release, get them in the crisis psychiatric center. That has really kind of boosted the awareness for law enforcement officials. About 3 years ago, the Sheriff's Office applied for a COPS grant to kind of take our work with the mentally ill pre-custody to the next level. And what we did is we applied and got a position that was funded. It was a deputy sheriff position that we teamed up with a qualified mental health provider. And we then began taking referrals from law enforcement agencies, any agencies in Marion County with folks that they've come across, that they've been dealing with, that have mental issues, that have been having engagements with law enforcement. And we were following up with those individuals kind of after the fact, and referring them to resources. So, again, trying to mitigate their escalation of their issues, trying to get them some help so that we kept them out of the criminal justice system. And we've seen phenomenal results with just after the fact. I mean, we have case after case where we've de-escalated folks, got them into services, got them healthy, and they weren't a demand on public safety resources. So that was very promising. We teamed together with the Salem Police Department, so we got a Salem police officer as well, and so we had kind of a collaborative effort, and that's gone well. The last iteration, and it just started about a month ago, and it was through a grant through OHA, we now have mobile crisis. And so we have a deputy sheriff and a Salem police officer who work together in tandem. They cover 7 days a week with a qualified mental health provider. They're out on the streets and available to respond to calls when somebody is in crisis and to take over that call from the law enforcement agency, work with the individual, and, you know, with an overall goal of diverting them out of the criminal justice system and into a community resource that will help them with their issue that they're facing.
Jason, how is this funded? I think all of us are sitting here thinking, I hope I can have this in my community.
Yes.
How is this being funded?
So the initial iteration was a COPS grant, and that is about to end, and so we're working to see if we can continue that. That's the after the fact. We still think that's important because some cases aren't as big of a crisis, but we still like to follow up with those individuals because that can change at a moment's notice. The mobile crisis we have right now is funded through an OHA grant. Otherwise, our local funding source, there's just not enough to be able to do that. So that's how that's funded. So, and again, I think the point that's been made here about resources, they vary across the state. You know, we have a lot more resources than maybe Crook County does or Klamath County, but we don't have as many resources as Multnomah County. So, you know, the resources are difficult. And then when you break that down to the level of being able to work with folks, the nonprofit organizations, you know, that's the same issue in each community. We probably have a lot more nonprofit organizations and referral organizations that we can refer folks to that are, you know, having a mental illness issue. Those resources may not be in Lake County or some of the smaller counties. So that's the difficulty, I think, I think all of us have the same goal, and it's to, best utilize the resources we have and help people in the time of need. But a lot of it's resource-driven.
So have then the referrals from Marion County, have they decreased since you've been working on these programs? Because I seem to recall you saying, Greg, that it increased over time, the referrals from Marion County. Did I remember that correctly?
Representative Tomei, I have that data here with me. I have the numbers from each county. I wouldn't want to guess. I think I don't know.
Yeah, and our crisis response just started about a month ago, so time will tell if that mitigates this. I'm hopeful that it will. One of the things that I've done over the last every 2 years is we do a study of our offenders that are in custody, and we find out the circumstances that lead them to being in custody. And over the last two studies, so it'll be over the last 4 years, 35 to 38% of the individuals in custody admitted to having a diagnosed mental health condition. So we're going to be doing another study this year, and I'm hopeful to see that percentage going down because that would be a sign that we're on the right track here with the initiatives that we put together. But it is the biggest issue in public safety.
It is.
It's the biggest issue that probably drives a lot of our resources. And so we're really trying to be forward thinking in the way that we address this and hopefully bring relief to all of our systems in that way. And I'll just leave you with the last piece. We do have qualified mental health providers in our jail. We've had them since, I think it goes back to 2005, 2004. There's two of them that work there. They, again, if somebody does ultimately end up getting arrested, their crimes are egregious enough that we need to hold them in custody, then they're working with these folks. If they don't go the 370 process, they're helping connect them to resources in the community so that when they do get released that we're not seeing these folks, recycle through the system again. So we have a thoughtful system, but again, it's the best that we can do by cobbling all these resources together to address this concern.
Good. Good job. Thank you. Cheryl, last but not least, and you're sort of a point person here in the sense that you're bringing these services to this population.
Good morning, Representative Tomei, committee members. I am Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, which represents all of the county-based mental health program directors and health and human service directors across the state. And in the interest of time and because the previous presenters really, I think, framed the problem and explained the 370 program, I'm just going to quickly go over a summary of the 370 pilot project that began in 2007 in the counties with the most 370 clients at OSH. And then I'll just go through.
And what counties were they shared?
Those are Marion, as mentioned, Multnomah, Lane County, and Douglas County. And just an FYI, I believe the last I looked, Klamath County was number 5. But the pilot took place in those 4 counties that had the most people in the state hospital. So I'm just going to go over that just for a few minutes, and then I'll just go right to the recommendations. You do have my full written testimony, though, that kind of goes over more of the problems and things like that. So this pilot was created in 2007 to see how 370 clients could be assisted in the communities to transition them from the state hospital into the community and get them out of the criminal justice system. So some of the things that were provided in these pilots were rental assistance, assessments, medications, aid and assist training, the creation of diversion agreements with county courts and jails, and then assisting OSH in discharging the 370 clients. There are a couple bright spots. Of course, Rod Calkins has talked about Marion County already and what they're doing, so I'll just mention a couple of others. Lane County has a dedicated 370 house, so that's for 370 clients and includes more supervision and support for them to keep them out of the state hospital. Multnomah County has a forensic diversion program trying to keep them from going into the hospital in the first place and pursuing local prioritization of individuals who are moving to the state hospital. So I'm just going to jump, like I said, to the recommendations that come out of the problems that have been mentioned by everybody before me. First, and there are 3 major groups of recommendations. And let me just say, the pilot counties, those 4 counties, we got together and we talked about how that pilot project went and lessons learned, problems that came up. And this is what that group came up with in terms of recommendations for decreasing the 370 population at OSH. So the first is, consider the individual circumstances when determining whether or not to admit to OSH or to serve them in the community. That is, rather than potentially not allowing any people with misdemeanors in the state hospital, it's a good idea to look at what their circumstances are and consider person-to-person crimes, for example. And I think that was a public safety concern specifically. Mm-hmm. 2, of course, you've heard this about 5 times, which is really encouraging to me and to our group, increase resources in the communities. Of course, for communities to provide the restoration services, we need more transitional housing at higher levels of care, and I think you even heard that in the last panel. Intensive outpatient services, forensic ACT teams in supportive housing situations, independent forensic evaluators in communities, although I know Marion County said that they have a forensic evaluator. Not all communities do, so that's an issue. Medication, co-occurring disorders treatment. You heard a lot of these people have substance use issues, so that's important. In Marion County, I'm not sure if Rod mentioned this, but I heard from his staff that A&D peer mentors have been really, really helpful for 370 clients. And then in terms of using maybe funding saved from hospitalization at OSH, use funding from that to access supported residential services and the Adult Mental Health Initiative Aim High services for 370 clients. Because I don't know if this came up, but because they're forensic clients, they haven't had access to the Aim High funding. So that's a really great program, but they need they need to be able to access that funding as well. And then the third broad category of recommendations is improved communication and process, and that's among mental health, public safety, and judiciary. We heard from several community mental health program directors that they didn't know that there were they had a 370 client in at OSH until a family member called them. So they were not at all involved in the process at the community level, and they should be. They should know about that. So there should be agreements between community mental health programs and jails that the mental health personnel can talk to those clients before evaluation. They should be notified, CMHPs, that is, community mental health programs should be notified when the judge sends the individual with the 370 designation to Oregon State Hospital. We believe that the judiciary system could use education by community mental health programs on service differences between aid and assist population and civil commitment. I gave that example of the Aim High program, that's an example. And then also the symptoms versus a 370 designation. And then the community alternatives to jail hospitalization. We believe that maybe some people in the judiciary system do not realize what services there are in the community and believe that, you know, it's either jail or OSH. So we need to inform them of what there is in the community. And then another potential recommendation is to conduct in-house evaluations that are similar to the civil commitment investigations that are that the community mental health programs do have responsibility over. And then to consider an outpatient commitment alternative. There are pockets of that going on around the state, including in Multnomah County.
These are great recommendations. And colleagues, we have a two-pager here.
Okay.
And on the last page are the suggestions, recommendations. So, Cheryl, how does this happen? What does the legislature need to do something? Does PAM need to do something? The state hospital? Judiciary, how do we put this into operation?
There are a couple of things. One is, and I think Representative Greenlick asked this question, of why this spike in 2010. And one thing I didn't mention, but I think it was mentioned by Rod, was that it seems that defense attorneys started advising that their clients go to Oregon State Hospital for restoration. And I think, I'm not saying that's the only thing that happened in 2010, but that's one thing that happened that may have contributed to the spike in 370 clients. So there may be, you know, statutory changes to remedy that. I don't know. Of course, more funding always for community-based programs. And then the communication piece is probably the cheapest and easiest.
Right.
And,
so how does that happen?
Well, that's just more of what, let's say, Marion County is doing with their
workers. And this is sort of an informal basis.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some way that we can formalize that so it happens throughout the state and not just in one county?
I don't know. I would hope so. I mean, I think...
How would we do that? How
certainly
do you think
we would advocate for that.
I know you would advocate for it. How do we operationalize it?
If I may...
Mm-hmm.
One of the things our work group is doing is just struggling with that issue because we said, oh, okay, we all need to educate each other about what's available, what's not available, what constraints we're all working under. We are going to, within that work group, actually have some folks come in versed in the lean process, which has been used in a number of areas to define systems in a way that then are quite understandable from the outside for people looking in.
Is this just for Marion County or is this statewide?
I think we're going to do it for the work group that we're working on, but I think one of the things we're thinking about for the Marion County work group and a pilot out of that would be that that would inform what could happen throughout the state.
I see Pam shaking.
It's going to need
Pam can make that happen, right?
It's going to need to be modified.
Pam, you can inform the rest of the state at the success of Marion County. Is that correct? We'll be checking back with you.
Representative, yes. I would, in response to your question, too, I think, Rod, I think hit the nail on the head earlier. This is very complex situation. And one of the issues, not only for this issue, but for others, there's no standard practice across the state when it comes to these. There are mental health courts, but they're not all operating in the same way. I think we have to include them in the discussion. But it's the complex, complicated issue is made more difficult by the fact that there's such variation from county to county. So we're looking, I think, to establish more of a standard approach to this on these issues. So,
Representative Greenleaf, this was another issue that we talked about, standardizing, and it just... How do we make this happen? That was one of the things we worked on in those bills that we passed. Was that 07, 9, whenever it was? 11?
It was 11. Time passes when you're having fun.
What's that?
The time passes when you're having fun.
I know, I'm having a great time. But I just, it's so frustrating when there seems to be general agreement that this is what should be happening. So what do we do to make sure that this happens? So we'll be coming back and asking this question again. Pam, poor Pam, so much falls on her shoulders. But we're going to be coming back, and we're going to be hearing this issue in judiciary tomorrow. I know that we have somebody from the Attorneys Association. We'll be hearing from you tomorrow. How is it that attorneys suggest that their folks go into 370?
I have a close relationship with the next defense attorney, who told me sometimes his recommendations to his client is, where can he get services? And that he would make unusual suggestions to his client if he thought that was the best way to get the mental health services he needed. So I think they're right. I think having services available in the community that can be easily accessed is a very...
Yes, I agree. So Cheryl and Pam will be looking for you. Yes,
so,
Representative Geyer.
Thank you. I know that part of trying to create more effective services in the community is obviously resources. And one of the questions that keeps coming up for me are there tools that are being used in the state hospital that we have not allowed by statute to be used in community services? And it might have to do with the override on medication. I mean, they're very sticky issues. I get that there's a very sticky, civil rights issues in this, but I know that the issues on the secured facilities and the lack of ability to control certain patients who might be hurting workers or other patients has been a big concern too. So I just, in terms of not just resources, but what are the variety of tools that might direct people toward a state hospital, because a state hospital has those tools that are not available in the community. And there may be good reasons why not, but I feel like that's a piece of the picture that I don't understand very well.
What do you need, Representative, to understand that better? What would you like?
Well, I don't have a sense of the differences of what the tools are that the hospital, I keep hearing kind of referrals to it, but I don't know the system well enough. But as we go step up, step down, obviously we need the resources to have those different levels of step up and step down, and we need a qualified workforce. We don't have enough, psychiatrists, all of those kinds of things. I just heard from a constituent about the low number for instance, child and adolescent psychiatrists that we have in Oregon. It's a problem nationally. It's even worse here. So there's workforce issues. But then there are also tools. What are we allowing by statute in certain areas and not allowing? And so those are all different components of trying to provide what's needed in the community to avoid sending people to the state hospital.
Representative, if I could respond. I think that's a great question, and we can certainly look to put that list together. I think the informed involuntary medication process is part of it, but also the fact we're a 24-hour secure facility, access to medication at no cost to the patient, even if the patient is willing to take medication voluntarily, there could be a medication
there
access
is
issue.
Restraint
as
issues,
well. Mm-hmm.
The whole variety of issues
right.
that are really
right.
sticky issues, I know,
right.
but I think we have to grapple with them.
Payment of non-physician.
Reimbursement.
I just want to say that it's my understanding the biennial budget for DHS OHA is $25 billion in the 2013-15 time period that we're looking at. I was wondering how much actually, do we have any idea, sort of a general question, how much goes to mental health of this $25 billion that the state is spending? To me, it just seems like mental health is a driving factor in a lot of the societal issues that we have, both related to, you know, policing or whatever. I mean, to me, we need to, just as a legislature, look at where the money is going and make sure that mental health is right up at the top of the list, because so many other things are derived from those issues. So I don't know how to find that out.
I don't know either.
Representative Tomei and Representative Wiss, we can get you that information. We know what the addictions and mental health budget is, and we can add that to funding that comes through Medicaid. And then what we may miss from that analysis are some grants and other things that are in communities that we may not know about. But we could get that pretty close.
That would help.
So we'll get that to the committee.
And probably we should get something from the criminal justice system, uh-huh. because I think a lot of people are in mm-hmm. county jails and also in the state prisons who are mentally ill, and they're because of their mm-hmm. mental illness and behavior. Yeah. Representative Gallego.
Well, I see Representative Kenny Garris left, but I just, you know, to me it's really part of the same question. I mean, what kind of resources do we have in hospital in terms of medication, alternatives, and so on? What do we need to look at in terms of affordable housing, support housing? What do we look at in terms of the cost-benefit? I mean, it is really just a very complicated, very complex kind of issue, but I think it is very critical that we address this. And I think you're right, put a priority on this rather than some other things.
Great. I think so, too. Any last words?
I just want to thank the committee for your interest in this very important area that, as you can see, spans so many of our public systems. Thank you.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you all for the work that you're doing and coming to testify today. So we're going to change our agenda a little bit. You missed a great presentation. Do we have a video of this?
I know.
So we're going to have the update on the implementation of Senate Bill 964, which is about the differential response. This is because one of our speakers is not here yet. Okay, thank you so much for coming.
Something that's a non-personal.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director at the Department of Human Services. And with me is Stacy Lake, who is the Differential Response and In-Home Services Manager. We appreciate you giving us a slot of your time to give you an update on where we are with implementing differential response and the statute regarding strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families programs. Can you hit the slides? I just wanted to briefly review why we're changing our practice, which is what differential response is. Circumstances and needs of families really differ depending upon what's challenging them, and we wanted our system to be as flexible as possible in creating a response to that. We looked at what was coming in the front door of child welfare, and our caseloads are dominated by neglect and threat of harm, which are sort of an accumulation of events or lack of events that end up in a child being neglected, which is a category of abuse. It's different than physical abuse or sexual abuse, which are pretty much an incident based abuse. And the children who are experiencing neglect were coming into care at a higher rate than children that experienced other forms of abuse, and they were staying for a longer period of time. And what that said to us is that we really needed to look at our interventions to see if they were effective in meeting the needs of these families where the neglect was occurring. Finally, child protection is a pretty significant governmental intrusion in the family life, and we wanted to make sure that our intervention matched the level of issue that was challenging the family. We looked across the nation and saw that many states were implementing what was called differential response, which is differentiating the front door of the child welfare system to offer more than one avenue of response to families, dependent more on the family's needs as they're identified when we get the call versus how the system is structured. So we've been spending a great deal of time the last year and a half planning and designing for the implementation of this differentiated system in child welfare. And this additional method of engaging families really is working to help them, working cooperatively with them to address the issues that, frankly, most families know they have. These are families who are in trouble, know they're in trouble and need help, and we want to engage them in a way that facilitates us being that help agent versus a more intrusive agent.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I find your comments right now very intriguing. The front door and accessing the needs right now for the family's intervention, engaging the families, and that you're trying to look for the troubled families that know that they're in trouble. I'm curious, what's the percentage of how many families? Because I'm thinking how many families are out there that don't care and don't even want you to be there in their lives. Yeah, I mean, I've seen that, so I'm just curious.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, I'm not prepared to tell you how many families don't care. What I can tell you is that we're very successful in engaging families and children returning home, and what we want to do is to be able to engage them earlier. My experience is that families want to do what's right for their children, and that our families, this domination of our caseloads by neglect and threat of harm, is we're finding the issues challenging families are ones that are challenging lots of people in our communities. It's poverty driven, it's lack of access to affordable housing, it's lack of access to services or lack of ability to know how to get to the services they need. It's not having the supports they need to make the changes, and when confronted, if you will, or engaged in a conversation around the well-being of their children, our experience is when we're able to do that effectively, parents can say, I know I need to do it differently and I want to. I didn't come with the numbers, but I can get them for you. But the bulk of the children that come into care really go back home. We know 11% of the children that enter care return home within 60 days. So our engagement of families at that front end, when we first intervene, we really wanted to differentiate how we were able to do that and not just have one standard way. And Stacy's going to speak a little bit about what other states have found when they have employed a differentiated system. And if there are some metrics, specific metrics you want me to get to around return home, those sort of things, I can get that for you.
So, I'd actually be fun to just sit down and visit with you.
I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Stacy Lake. For the record, I am the Differential Response Manager for DHS. And I can just add a few stats that that I have off the top of my head. Over 60% of the families that we encounter through child welfare have to do with neglect and threat of harm neglect. So they're coming to our attention due to neglect-related issues. In 2012, we had approximately 65,000 reports called in to our hotlines, and after we screened those reports, we went out and actually did CPS assessments on about 30-some thousand of those reports. And then once we look at those reports that were actually assessed, about 20% of those were founded, meaning we actually found abuse or neglect had occurred. So you can see the funnel effect. And then out of those 20% that were founded, there were really about 20-some percent that were removed. So the majority of children, as Ms. Day already mentioned, actually do remain in their home safely. I just want to talk a little bit more about the work that we've been doing around differential response. We've created a differential response vision statement, which I have here, and we actually invited DHS staff from around the state and community partners to come together to help us to do that, to create a vision for what differential response would look like here in Oregon. And how they did that was they looked at what other states were doing around differential response. They looked at the research. Most states that have put differential response in place have done an evaluation of some sort. A few of those states have done really rigorous evaluations, such as Minnesota and Ohio, that we've looked more closely at. And what they found was that children are just as safe, whether they're served in an alternative kind of CPS response or a traditional kind of response. They find that there's less repeat maltreatment, so we tend to see families back again less often through a differential response system. They saw a decrease in their placement rate, so children coming into foster care, that decreased. That was down the line. Took a little time to see those kind of effects. They also saw a decrease in disproportionality. They saw that...
What does that mean?
Disproportionality is the disproportionate representation of children of color in our child welfare system, and there's as it relates to the general population, and there's disproportionality in a lot of systems, not just child welfare, justice, criminal justice, education. You find issues related to that.
And so help me understand what the differential response then, what effect that would have. Are you saying you see fewer people of color or different nationality through the differential response, or they get out of the system as quickly as other people? Help us understand that.
Chair Tomei, committee members, thank you for the question. I think what we see is that the alternative approach, having these two approaches, mm-hmm. traditional and alternative, is more culturally responsive because you are involving family in a different way. You're engaging family in a different way. What we find is that what the other states found in their evaluations was that families felt more involved in the decision-making process. They felt more included in coming up with how they're going to keep their children safe, or if their children were safe, but they felt like they needed services, they were more involved in determining and identifying what those services are, and then they were more likely to actually access those services. So then what you find is kind of an early intervention approach. If families access services while their children are safe in an attempt to keep things from possibly escalating in the future, you wind up with less children coming into care in the future. Some of the other things that the other states found was that that families were more satisfied with their experience with child welfare. So, to speak to Vice Chair Olson's question, I think not that people invite us child welfare into their lives, but they found themselves more satisfied when they did have involvement with us. And lastly, the workers, the caseworkers, were more satisfied in this kind of approach because they felt like there was more flexibility and they were able to approach families in a different way. And, of course, that helps, I hope, with issues like turnover, which is which we find in child welfare systems across the nation. And lastly, what I'd like to mention is the differential response vision and the differential response work is really a strategy in the overarching goal that child welfare has, which is safe, equitable foster care reduction.
Hi, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'd just make a comment. We're talking about creating a system with two tracks of response. We have what we call the traditional track, which is a very needed and critical method of intervening with families who have more severe levels of abuse occurring in the home, and we will continue to have that track. It's an essential element of the system. And what we are focusing on today, I don't want people to lose track of the fact that we have that track as well, but we're focusing on this addition primarily today.
Yes, thank you.
So that would be mainly dealing with families where you have to take a child out of the home or you have to have more intense involvement with that home because you fear the child will be harmed?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, that is correct. It's where we believe court intervention is needed frequently. It's where there's a law enforcement investigation or some level of criminal activity that would continue to create a lack of safety for the child, and the issues in the home are such that we simply can't keep the child safe at home while we're working with the family.
So let me just clarification.
Sure.
That's what you're identifying as traditional response.
Yes.
Where there's a criminal investigation involved.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, not just where there's a criminal investigation involved, but you will find in the higher levels of abuse, we frequently have a criminal investigation involved. Even today, we have cases where where the child can be safe at home and we may not be involved with the family, but a criminal investigation continues around an allegation of abuse.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, and we expect the majority of the cases that we serve in the traditional response will really be focused on your more severe kinds of abuse and neglect, mostly around physical abuse and sexual abuse kind of allegations. So I just want to talk a little bit about the interplay of a variety of things that have been happening for a successful implementation of differential response. The first thing is the statewide implementation of the Strengthening, Preserving, and Reunifying Families legislation from Senate Bill 964 in 2011. And we've been working to put services in place for several years now, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But it's critical to implementation of differential response because one of the things that we are working to do is when we identify that a child's safe within a family, but they seem to have some moderate to higher needs, we'd like to really get them into some services, again, to try to get towards that early intervention approach in the hopes that they will not come back to our attention or won't escalate to the point of needing to be have a child removed from their home. So those services are critical. Then the second part is the Oregon safety model. That is our practice model. That's how we make child safety decisions throughout the life of a child welfare case, from the point that we get a call to the point that a child reaches permanency. So we've been working really closely with our supervisors across the state for the last year to make sure everybody understands the concepts of our safety model clearly, to make sure that they're consistently practicing, and to help them coach their staff around practicing the model consistently so that we're really understanding which children are safe and taking and which children are unsafe and only taking those more intrusive actions when that's clearly needed. Then, of course, we have received more staff from the last legislative session, and we've been hard at work getting those positions hired and those staff trained, and are certainly grateful for that. So we have more staff to be able to do the work. And then last but not least, we have we've been working on actually developing what the differential response model is going to look like here in Oregon. I've mentioned that many states already have differential response in place, but they all have slightly different iterations of what that looks like. So again, we've had a lot of community and staff involvement from across the state. And I mentioned that first team we brought together to help us vision what this was going to look like. After that, we moved to we have well over 100 people who have been involved in helping us build this model, including staff of all levels, not just child welfare, but self-sufficiency, as well as community partners. We have had providers involved. We've had judicial involvement. We've had tribal involvement. We've actually had parents at the table. So a variety of those kind of folks helping us develop this model. So the second part of model development is we're doing what's called a staged implementation. So we don't want to start differential response everywhere in the state at once. What we've learned from the other states is we really want to take the time to start in a few counties, see how it goes, make the changes that we need to before we continue to roll that out across the state.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I suspect that this may be too early yet, but I'm just curious about the evaluation, the assessment process, and is there a comparative analysis between sort of what you call the traditional model and the differential response model? I'm sure it's a complicated sort of set of variables that we'd be looking at, but where is the assessment evaluation component at?
Yes, Representative Tomei and Representative Gallegos, we actually are in the process of bringing on an external evaluator to help us evaluate differential response. We had a subcommittee that worked for some time on putting together an evaluation plan to guide what our request for proposal would look like. We had a variety of people on that subcommittee. We had our internal research folks. We also have Casey Family Programs helping us, Portland State University, and actually a national researcher who's been involved with doing differential response researcher helped as well.
What's your timeline? I mean, can we anticipate, I mean, I know you need time to really implement and get data to build your data set, but can we anticipate maybe hearing what the evaluation plan is maybe by September or something like that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, I would estimate you could hear what the plan, we could give you preliminary plans, what we put out in the RFP, but probably design not until January would be my guess.
So at least we have a sense, yeah.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt, it sounds like you're going to be getting some services there already starting that. So, yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah, so going along with the staged implementation, we started in Klamath and Lake Counties just on Tuesday this week, and are starting in Lane County this morning. So differential response is actually in place here in Oregon. We've spent about the last month and a half training over 500 employees and community partners, getting them ready. We've actually done a whole lot of readiness work in Klamath, Lake, and Lane County, so that we weren't only getting their staff ready, but we're actually helping them work with their communities to get folks on the same page about what differential response is and how that interaction may look different in the future. So they have local implementation teams, advisory teams that we're helping them think through some of the details, and we'll continue to help them think through those any bumps that they hit along the way.
We're going to ask you to sort of wrap it up. We have another hearing.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Then we'll quickly just give you the high points on the Strengthening, Preserving, and Unifying Families programs. In the PowerPoint, it has some of the critical elements. This is a collaborative process between the department and county partners to identify gaps in the service array and then to fill those gaps with funding that the legislature has provided to expand the service array. Currently, there's a map that shows you our implementation, and everyone is in process and close to complete. We have 86 contracts in place in 19 counties, and we gave you a list of those there so you could see who is fully on board and who we're still working with to get on board. And then we gave you themes in the service array, and I want to just take 1 minute to speak about this. There are some themes, and you heard them earlier in the presentations, supported housing with a wraparound of services to help families understand and cement the changes they need to make to be successful in not falling back into the system. Navigators, parent mentors, life coaches, home visiting, people who can actually go arm in arm with families to help them learn how to move through the system in a functional way and how to move through life in a more functional way. Teaming in our initial contacts with families, with specialists to take advantage of that moment of intervention. And here's an area where there's mental health funding that won't show up in Dr. Martin's assessment, because we are contracting for additional mental health services to expand that array for these families. And then services to strengthen the parent and child relationship, both in the parenting skill set, but also in relief nurseries, connecting families again, and then increasing visitation so that you may start with just a little but can expand that and then have a successful transition home for children who are in the foster care system. So that's a quick on 964. And the last slide really just says a thank you for the investment that the legislature's made in this program and in the system as a whole, because I think it's going to be a wonderful turning point for Oregon and these families.
Absolutely. This is very exciting. I mean, it sounds sort of dry at this point, but it is really very exciting. As someone who started out her professional career as a caseworker for Children's Services and supervising foster homes. This is just a wonderful, wonderful program, so it'll be exciting to see how it plays out. There's a question from, yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Day, go back to your last slide, please.
Yes, sir.
And I'm still not sure about the traditional and the differential. Three things that I've worked on since I've been in the legislature are grandparents' rights in the system and family find. And another third thing is that when the judges decide not to place a child within family and in a home, foster home, instead of with family, they have to issue a report of finding. Where do these, which of these fit in as far as traditional or differential program? And I see some things here that I thought was coming under early childhood learning, relief nurseries, parenting.
Chair Tomei, a representative, wasn't it? All of those things are firmly fit in our system regardless of which track is utilized. I think the family finding and grandparents' rights, I mean, family finding happens in both tracks because connecting these families with functional relatives and other supports is part of them being successful over time. The grandparents' rights comes into place when a child's placed in care and the court system is involved, and that's primarily that is the traditional track when a child comes into care, and so we continue to utilize that. And you're right, there is some overlap with early learning. What we're finding with these dollars that the legislature provided is that we're being able to create some infrastructure in communities that didn't exist. So some places have relief nurseries, other counties didn't, and we're able to help them get it started, and then additional dollars will come in from other places for families that aren't child welfare families but still need that level of service and access. So we know we're working closely with the early learning and actually working on a county level with CCOs around the kind of services this subset of families need and how we can coordinate that with the larger set of services that all families need in the community.
Yes, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Did you go to Hawaii when you stepped out a little while ago?
Constituent who's originally from Hawaii who was the champion for a bill. I'm sorry, I had to step away for a bill signing on a bill I carried for him, but he
That's nice.
Graced us all with this. So, you had ORCIDs on the previous. I'm just wondering if you can give us a quick date. I know there was a lot of a quick update. There was a lot of disruption in reimbursement services and things like that, and I would like to know if the providers have all been brought up to date on reimbursement and how that database is working.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer. I believe the ORCID system is working fairly well. We had a bumpy start, as you all heard, with the transition and in the conversion of some of the data that challenged us. We've been working hard at improving the provider reimbursement portion of that, the financial portion, and I think at this point we're almost cleared, and we are making effective payment now. It's making sure that we've cleaned up anything that occurred before to make sure that everyone is sort of right in their payments from the past. We recently had a preview of that system. It's our SACLIS system, and the federal government will come out and evaluate it at a certain point, but they have a sort of a pre-evaluation. They use a contractor to come out. They had some very positive things to say about the system in terms of some innovations that we've done and changes that we've made from the system that we purchased that made it more responsive. We're finding caseworkers who are more recently hired find it very sort of easier to use, and with caseworkers who might have been hired when I was, we might struggle a little bit more with the transition to the new system. Mm-hmm. I still liked it when we had the sheet of paper we turned over right on the back.
I remember that.
But things have changed and progressed. So I'm feeling very positive about our system, and I feel positive about the fact that we're able to very quickly get some changes needed for differential response into the system, and they work well.
Thank you
for asking.
Thank you very much, and we wish you well, and we want you to come back later and tell us how everything is working out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now we're moving on to the update about C6, sex trafficking of children. And can you don't need this thing, do you?
No.
Good. Can you pull that up and open up the windows? Thank you so much. We've been waiting for Amanda Marshall, and I knew she couldn't be here until 10, but we're still waiting. So go ahead.
Even there,
Representative Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Amy Baker, and I'm the Child and Family Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division with the Oregon Health Authority. And the last time I was here, I was giving you an update on where we were at with the CSEC facility that got funded last September by the tobacco tax. And I believe at that time the plan was to put that out to bid. It is currently out to bid. That will close on June 11th. We have scheduled a very robust and rigorous review panel that will review all of the applications, made up of various folks who are intimately familiar with working with this population. We anticipate having a contract start date of August 1st. The hope is to have services start in September or October, but it's really dependent on whether or not the applicant will need to make building modifications to the program to really suit this particular population.
I'm sorry, I just got information. Amanda won't be here, so
Okay.
No, there was a misunderstanding. Sorry.
And as I described a little bit last time, the designing of this program has been really challenging in the sense that there's not a lot of evidence-based practices that have been implemented across the country. And so part of our process included contacting five residential facilities that do exist to really figure out lessons that they learned, what's working, and what they would do differently if they had the opportunity to re-implement those programs. And part of the debate has been with this particular population is whether you go with a locked or unlocked facility. They found in a national study that fewer than half of CSEC victims thought that their pimps or exploiters were not working on their best interest. And so basically, we have a lot of young girls who don't actually see themselves as being exploited. And part of our conversation with these programs were, would you go with locked or unlocked? And we couldn't really find anybody who supported going the locked route, because the reality is eventually these girls are going to have to find their voice, develop their skill set, and move on. And I think the other piece that's particularly challenging with this population is that in another national study, they found that 95% of these girls have a history of sexual abuse. And so their general experience is that adults are not trustworthy. And so that's part of the challenge in terms of designing services is really dealing with that perception that they have and really trying to undo some of the damage that's been done. So as we looked at designing this, what we came up with was it's a 12-bed facility. We're serving younger kids between the ages of 11 and 15, in part because we really wanted to get to them sooner. On average, girls enter into the life between 12 and 14. And part of the goal is to actually get to them before they become too entrenched. Of course, that being said, this is a learning process. We anticipate that we will, as we implement this program, we may need to make changes, and that's part of our expectation is that there'll be a rigorous quality improvement process to really determine whether or not it's working and whether or not we need to make shifts to the program. So, and then the other piece is that in terms of the program, we're looking at a length of stay between 11 and 14 months. And part of what's going to help this be successful is our ability to help establish healthy attachment relationships between these girls and basically people who are not paid to care. Because whether it's child welfare or mental health, we are temporarily involved in their life. And as you know, for kids to be successful, they need to have healthy attachment figures. And part of this may include family find in terms of if we have kids who don't have viable parents, who else in their family could be available? We have a contract with an entity that can help do that for us. How we're going to measure success on this? I have a couple things. One, we've set realistic expectations of these kids are going to run. And so part of what we measure is stays, that they actually stay in the program. And then we measure whether or not they're continuing to glamorize the life, because they do that. It's, for some of these girls, it's the first time that they've had somebody pay attention to them and have some kind of an attachment, even if it's not a healthy attachment. Days attending school, employment, all those kinds of things. And so the expectations are realistic, but my hope, of course, is that we're going to run a program that gets kids into college and employment and all those kinds of things, so that they have the opportunity to live the life that they deserve to have.
Amy, could you talk some about the prevalence of young girls, especially, but girls and boys, being sex trafficked in the Oregon, the state of Oregon?
I don't actually know what the overall prevalence is. I can get that data for you. I know that in terms of risk factors, I think they found that 25% of girls who were sexually abused were at much higher risk for being sex trafficked.
Didn't Portland State do a study?
They did.
And tell me about that. Tell us about that. It was how they found, as I recall, wasn't it 400?
400.
It was 400.
Yeah, 400 girls. On the streets.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
At any one time?
At any one time.
At any one time.
Yeah.
Well, and the reality is, too, is that at this time, our ability to identify who these kids are isn't where it needs to be. Like, if we really look at designing a system of care, like, we will be able to identify who's at risk more quickly and actually provide intervention to prevent that, because there's some clear factors that would show who could be at risk for being sex trafficked. And it's actually in part why we are working so closely with child welfare, because there's a huge correlation between their kids and our kids.
Representative Kenneth Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the 400 is a statewide estimate?
No, that was primarily out of Portland.
Portland Metro area. Do you have any sense of how it compares to now in the state?
I don't, in part because of what I was talking about earlier with the screen. I think this is what I'm hearing, is that within local communities, they're starting to form task force particular to this issue. Like, I know Clackamas is, I think Benton is, I think they are out in
Bend
and Hood River. And so people, it's popping up on people's radar screen. But in terms of really identifying who it is, I don't think we've quite gotten there yet. But I suspect it's far broader than just the 400 kids noted in the Portland State study.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you want to add to this?
Sure. Representative Tomei, my name is Marita Johnson, and I'm the current Deputy Director of Child Welfare. And to augment this shelter care program development, we've been working with the National Resource Center for Family and Permanent Connections. They are a free service to child welfare, and they provide us technical assistance in areas that are related to child welfare, this one being one. And they've been helping us with connecting us with treatment programs across the country so we can evaluate, you know, where programs have done well and where they haven't done well. They've convened phone calls with us with a couple of programs that have advised us on the best treatment methodology. And then they are also posing to provide us with some technical assistance to provide a statewide convening so we can develop our own statewide strategic plan in order to be able to intervene, have a plan to be able to intervene on these kids statewide. They've provided us with some self-assessment tools so we can look at our existing systems so we don't have to build a new system. And we're really thinking through perhaps having a system through our MDTs across the state where through the district attorney's offices they can really help us identify these kids at a local level and develop individual intervention plans, because as we know, what might make sense in Multnomah County certainly isn't going to make sense in Bend or in Jefferson County,
mm-hmm.
And then really help us think through how we can meet the needs of those kids in those individual areas. We also have an opportunity to apply for a $1 million grant. It's over 4 years, $250,000 a year. And we've been working with Victim Services through the Department of Justice to be the point for that grant. We think that it would be a very nice place for a CSEC coordination position to lie, because then it would be able to touch all of the mm-hmm. all of the children that could be involved in this life, not kids that come through the door through OIA or child welfare or through mm-hmm. mental health, and then really work with the MDTs on how we can best develop a system of treatment for kids who are involved in this life. And then we've also had some conversation about doing some aftercare services work through Wraparound Oregon, because likely these kids are going to have touched at least one of the other service points across the state, and then we're hoping that Wraparound can come in and really provide some aftercare service and supports for these kids. So
we are very lucky to have this program. We're very pleased to have had this mental health money to provide this program. We know it's just the first step, and it's targeting a young group of children because they're more able to avail themselves mm-hmm. of the kind of services that are being offered. They aren't as hardened as some of these girls. This issue, I think we've had this information before, it's increasing geometrically because of the internet. And they can't advertise for young girls, but they can say it in such a way, mm-hmm. a sweet young thing or a young body or whatever, that lets people know. And so it's too bad we don't have anybody here from law enforcement, but they can tell us that they set up stings. But they can't, we haven't had one John, and you and I remember this, we changed the legislation mm-hmm. so that these people would have, it would be a felony. But when I've asked the DAs, so how many people have you prosecuted under this law, they have done none, because it's extremely difficult. So I think the way we need to go is to denormalize. As long as women are seen as appropriate avenues for men to use, and that's okay, then if she's 19 or 18 or 17 or 12, it doesn't make much difference. They don't differentiate between what is okay sex with a prostitute and what is not okay sex. So it seems to me that's in conferences that I've been to, that we need to change the culture, that buying sex is not okay. It's especially not okay with children. So that's going to be a huge issue, and I think we're going to be working with the state agencies on public, what do you call it?
PSAs,
public service announcements, and different kinds of things to educate the public about this is not pretty woman, this is not pretty girl. These are real crimes, and these hurt women. I've worked with children and women all my adult life, and I've never yet heard a child or a young woman say, boy, I want to be a prostitute. But once they're in the life, it's really difficult to change that. So so one of the other things I was hoping we could talk about today, but the people who are going to talk about it aren't here, but talking about a board that will be developed, mm-hmm. similar to the CAMI board, that will oversee, because this is just one small piece. We recognize that. We need to do a lot more. And Representative from Silverton area, I know you're really interested in public-private partnerships, and that's one of the things we know. There are many, many private people of faith and the faith organizations. Representative, I'm sorry, you had a question.
Don't worry.
ask it quickly, and I can continue on my train.
Thank you, ma'am. I had a point with the governor. Take
my picture. Me too.
You too.
Yeah.
This whole committee and the legislative body is really concerned about this. I was going to ask, 12 is not a lot of beds, not a lot of people, and I think is it restricted to, and I think the majority are ladies, young girls, but it's also boys.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying, and as you were talking about it, we'd have the Attorney General, how we identify them, get them off the street, and get them into the treatment. That's what we're missing from the Attorney General's office.
Yeah.
And we heard that terrible report in the paper about the drug cartel using this to
Right. So. It's a huge issue. And this is just touching one small part of it. We know that it's just a small group of kids that this is going to be helping. But it's a start. And we need to set up a board. We need to set up a board that will be overseeing this and coordinating services, and especially contributions from the faith and the nonprofits who
Thank
are eager to help. But, buying them shampoo and nightgowns, that needs to be done, but that's really not sufficient. We need to coordinate all this and get people working together. And I'm going to let you finish, and I know somebody over here, Representative Gallegos, did you have what?
I just wanted to thank you for your work to begin with. But also, our chairperson mentioned the need for cultural change. And I just want to recognize that, things have changed in the past 10 years. 10 years ago, we trafficking was an international problem, not a local problem. And I think we've made a lot of headway into recognizing that it is very much a local problem. The one thing you didn't mention that I was curious about was some of the efforts to sort of look at some of the interstate kind of connections with regard to this issue. A lot of the girls are getting taken out of state and brought back, and there's just this whole flow back and forth. And I don't know if that would necessarily need to be some sort of a national intervention rather than a state concern, or how is that getting looked at?
And we'll have Amanda Marshall here next time. I was hoping she could be here today. But it is a national concern, and she's very involved with this. Mm-hmm. We've worked very closely with her. So we'll answer it next meeting.
Okay.
Representative Whitson.
Thank you for coming. And as a result of your presentation to us, we put on a local club down in Klamath, a meeting on sex trafficking, and we had 80 people show up for it, which is a lot for a small community, and a lot of them were young girls. And so they listened to the presentation, these junior high and high school girls, and they have asked us to go back out into each of the schools and put on a presentation. So we're waiting to hear from the school districts if they're going to allow it. But it's becoming much clearer to some of the people the kind of problem that we have. And I think the key is for the children to understand what is happening and then to carry it to their schools and sort of warn the other kids or whatever about it. But when you get that kind of involvement from little kids coming up and saying, we want you to come to our school and do this, and we have a 40% dropout rate down in our area, K-12, and so it's really imperative that we keep the kids involved and have them understand. So thank you very much for what you're doing and the awareness that you're bringing to the issue.
And by the time we have another meeting in September, you will have, I would assume, have started something. So we'll be able to get something concrete from that program. Rita, do you have any closing comments or questions or concerns?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming and for all the work you're doing. This is very exciting. I just want to tell you, we meet in my dining room every few weeks. And so Amanda Marshall was there yesterday. So was Ellen Rosenblum, who is the state attorney general. So we've had the Multnomah County member of the commission. She wasn't there yesterday. But we had, 20 people at my house? Leah was there, and both of these ladies. So it's exciting. There's a lot of interest. We've had people from the faith community, from the nonprofits, and we're really excited about moving ahead and having a big program. But this is a wonderful start, and this is very exciting. So thank you for all the people who have been working on this.
Thank you.
Anything else from committee? Thank you all, and I do, too, have an appointment with the governor. We're bill signing is what we're doing today. Thank you all. Thank you. See you in September. Maybe see some of you tomorrow. That will close the House Committee on Human Services.